And a very good morning, ladies and gentlemen. A big welcome to the program this morning. Pleased to say that I'm catching up and I'm going back into the media world with a good friend, but one of our finest journalists, racing journalists here in Australia, in Steve Moran. Good morning to you, Steve.
Morning, Brian. Good to be with you this morning. And I've listened regularly of late, and particularly interesting to hear Dean Lester a couple of weeks ago. That was great.
Yes, you could really align to Dean's theory on racing and where Dean's at, and highly regarded Dean in every aspect of racing, but he's part of the analytical team, isn't he? And that's probably where you sort of come from and still are.
Yeah, to some degree. And I thought we had something else in common because he mentioned Roy Higgins being his hero. And as a youngster, I think I had two heroes, Roy Higgins and Bill Collins. I was captivated by Bill Collins, who I think was probably and still is the most talented person ever to appear on the electronic media in Australia. As you know, there was nothing he couldn't do. He'd host the Miss Victoria Quest, he'd sing and dance on Sunnyside Up, and he called the races brilliantly. So.
And he'd be at the Greyhounds at Olympic Park on Monday night and be backing three in a race for the place.
Yes, and in the meantime, trying to teach me how to play solo, and I quickly learnt don't play billet cards.
Extraordinary man. Looking at your career, I see it sort of it captures about 35 years as a racing writer, from print to radio to television, racing editor of the Melbourne Sunday Age, editor of Best Bets, a writer at the Sporting Globe where I first met you, radio host on Sport 927, now RSN, racing host on TVN. You've covered a fair gamut of it all, haven't you?
Yeah, look, I've been blessed, I often say to kids these days, because you still get plenty who are interested in doing some aspect of racing journalism. If you want to make plenty of money, choose something else. If you'd like to have a charmed life, by all means get involved. And that's what I think I've had. I've had a charmed life, and I think it happened from the word go when I dropped out of uni, much to my father's disgust, and declared that I'd have a job in a newspaper within 3 days. And I did. I walked into the Herald and Weekly Times office to the personnel department seeking a job, and I remember the guy there at the time said, look, it could be your lucky day, son. And he took me around to meet the advertising manager, who was Mel McPherson was his name. He asked me one or two questions. Where did you go to school? Told him. He said, you must know my sons Tim and Patrick. And I said, well, sorry, sir, I don't. But it was, of course, a trick question. Is this kid going to spin me a story, which I didn't. He said, you start tomorrow. And that was a glorified clerical job in the advertising department of the Weekly Times, and it started from there.
What age?
19. And then I managed to sneak my way into the back door of the Sporting Globe, which of course was housed in that building. I think at the time they advertised for a low grade of journalists, and I thought, well, there can't be too many qualified journalists applying for this job. And I guess by that stage I'd got to know a couple of people, and so I flicked my way in there and had no formal training as a journo, but a couple of terrific role models in Rollo. Roy Lance, of course, was the chief racing writer at the time, the Chief Will Chestnut. I could find no fault with him. You know, Rollo was very old school, and the bottom line was get your facts right. Yeah. Worry about being entertaining and clever and amusing afterwards. Get your facts right.
Yeah. Very, very good, clear instruction for a young man coming through. Now, if we even roll back a little bit further, you told me something before we started to roll with the tape here. You grew up in Blackburn, so we've got a lot in common. You went to St Thomas's. We've got a fair bit in common. I didn't go to school there, but our kids did. And you said at 8 years of age, you're walking down Central Road there in Blackburn, and you met actually someone who was quite famous.
Well, yeah, certainly in my realm, but I'm sure he was shocked. I was strolling down Central Road, and there's an old fellow watering the garden, and he said, oh, excuse me, young fellow. He said, my name's Harry. And I looked at him and I said, you'd be Harry Bamber. You trained Rivette to win the Caulfield and Melbourne Cup double in 1939.
Wow.
And he looked at me and he was astonished. He was absolutely astonished that this eight-year-old kid would know that. But I think probably from the age of 6 or 7, and only under the influence of Dad, who was a punter. He owned the odd 5% in a horse or two, but had no direct involvement in the game other than being a punter. But I became immersed very early, mid-60s, as a kid. Lightfingers, of course, winning the Cup in 65, which and that captured me too, and the Roy Higgins element. And yeah, at the time it seemed like, you know, if Roy went to Werribee on a Wednesday to ride one, and it'd be 6-4 and trained by Angus Marmonesco, and, you know, memory tells you they just won. They just won every time.
Yeah, if you take the 6-4 or the 7-4, and the bookies would be on the rails, there'd be two or three rows there on a Wednesday. there's plenty of cash around. It was a good era to be through. And I spoke about this with Dean Lester and Brian Meldrum only recently. They were wonderful times in racing.
Yeah, they certainly were. And the level of involvement, I think, from the wider community was much more mainstream. And at the time, when I first started work at the Sporting Globe, I think there would have been 40-odd people employed doing racing to some degree in that building. You know, you had the three different papers, of course, the Daily Sun News Pictorial, the Afternoon Herald, the Sporting Globe, and the famous Guide to Form room. You know, this is how the world's changed. You know, the form was literally written out on A4, pieces of a cardboard, shuffled back in alphabetical order, and when declarations came out for a race meeting, you literally had to go in there and pull out every card and put them in race field order. And there were a huge number of people employed. It was amazing. There was a great buzz.
The form cards, yes, I remember those. And this is well before race replays and the comments in the guide, you know, needs further, not favoured, may need another one, hard to beat. You know, nothing's really changed through the years, has it?
No, it almost used to annoy me. There were a few particular favourites, which was, you know, maybe the horse in a distance race where the comment would be prefer over jumps, and you'd look and see it had fallen in its last three runs. Why would I prefer it over jumps? The characters then were amazing. You know, Jack Elliott. Mm. I love to tell this story about Jack, because the first time I set foot in a press room, Jack came up to me and quietly said, "Listen, young man, if you need an introduction to Colin Hayes or Tommy Smith," he said, "you just come and see me." And then he turned on his heel and he came back and he said, "Now, by the way," he said, "if you tell anyone I was nice to you, there'll be consequences."
Yes, he was a large figure, and he could actually destroy a young journo coming through, Jack Elliott. But they were characters, and I'm just working on a project at the moment, so I'm spending a fair bit of time at the State Library and looking back at those back pages of the Herald on a Saturday night and Friday's back page of the Sun News Pictorial. It'd be George Hanlon holding Correct, who's the favourite for the new market, the next day, and those days are long gone.
Yeah, they are. It probably doesn't have the same romance, but then, of course, you know, time probably tends to exacerbate our feeling of how romantic it was at the time. You know, I can't believe that I'm actually old enough to remember some of the things that we did at that stage. Like finishing orders of a race, they weren't officially done. It was usually a member of the press and a member of the race club. Half the time it was guesswork. The margins were guesswork. Half the time there might have been the odd bit of skullduggery, not to mention the official starting prices.
It's a separate issue.
Which were done by a member of the club, a member of the bookie supervisor's office, and a member of the press. Mm. Well, half the time the guy from the bookie supervisor office was called up in some other problem, punters blueing about something, the bloke from the club wasn't much interested, and half the time it was left to the member of the press. Now, I think there might have been the odd little rort perpetrated there as well.
Yes, well, a big difference about, you know, for a half a point as far as SP goes, isn't there?
Yes, I think there was another classic about, you know, these odds on chances of Armin Asco's, you know, always win. And, of course, you know, there'd be a little sling for the guy on the track. Now, if this gets beat, return it at 10 to 9, you know, because I've got the standing bet on the Armin Asco two-year olds at odds on. You know?
Yeah, some amazing tales, but the landscape changes so quickly. So if we just fast forward now, I see you riding a lot of great stuff actually online. You've got a strong connection to Hong Kong racing. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, look, I'm blessed there. I owe James Earls from the VRC a massive favour, which I've never quite got around to repaying. But I think it was back in 2000, the year that Sunline beat Fairy King Prawn and Adam in the mile. And earlier that year, James had a phone call from someone at the Hong Kong Jockey Club looking for an Australian journo to give them a hand. He gave them my number because I just happened to be the last person he spoke to. And I've been going there every year since, quite often twice a year, just assisting their media department, which is fantastic fun in December and April, May for the QE2 and the Champions Mile. And it's broadened my horizons. It's enabled me to meet a lot of people, racing people from around the world, which I wouldn't have otherwise done. And I think that's one of the best things that's happened in my career.
What I've seen in you taking up a job like that, you've got this this travelling lust, haven't you? Like, you'll bob up at Royal Ascot, you'll bob up at Cheltenham. We don't know where you're going to be, and you keep ticking them off as the bucket list. Is that correct?
Yeah, very much so. Look, I hasten to add that I was a father of two at a very, very young age and didn't travel in my 20s or 30s. So it's only more recently. And look, I'm happiest now when you stick me on a plane and destination unknown. I don't mind. I tend to link a major race meeting with extended travel, and it's been fantastic fun. I really enjoy the racing in Europe, particularly England and France. I think the fact that because they haven't been blessed with the cash cow that we've had, I think over the years their clubs have probably had to work harder. That's starting to change now, and our clubs are very committed now. But I think we went through a long period of time where the tab was such a cash cow. It's one of my most vivid memories from covering racing in probably the mid to late 70s. You'd go up to the committee room after the last, the crowd would be down, the then secretary, not chief executive, secretary, and you'd say, "Sir, you must be a little concerned about the decline in attendance." And they'd just look at you and say, "Son, have a look at this off-course TAB figure. We've made a fortune today." Now, I think they dropped the ball, and I don't blame them. That I would have done it. You would have
done it. And never got it back.
Never got it back. No. But I think in other parts of the world, they probably had to work a bit harder. Look, I know that turnover's obviously highly significant, but to attend these great race meetings in the UK or France where there's six feature races in the program, you can treat it like out of the footy if you wish. Get there a quarter to two, leave at 5 o'clock, or you can get there at 12:30, have a bit of lunch, socialise, you don't miss anything. See, I couldn't do that here. I could not see the first couple of races. You know, I've got to see the pattern. I've got to see what's going on. So there's, you know, it's very genteel, and obviously that's a legacy too of the fact that, you know, the wealthy people, particularly in the UK, have supported the racing. It hasn't relied on the man in the street supporting it. So that's probably given that luxury. It's allowed it to be a bit more genteel, but it doesn't make it better or worse, but it certainly makes it delightful.
I was interested to see where you said after going to Cheltenham a few years back that the festival at Cheltenham was the best you've ever seen. That's a big call.
Yeah, I think the atmosphere on the day is extraordinary. They're there to back a winner and for the horse. You know, there's very few ancillary activities. There's no face painters. There's no fashions on the field, or there certainly weren't when I was there. It's about backing a winner. It's about revering these horses. And I think they're probably a little more affable about the punt than we are. They're a bit less inclined to kick the cat when one gets beaten a short half head. You know, they tend to, the famous horses, the Denmans and the Kowtow Stars, you'll see them stand there and applaud the runner-up. And it's a fantastic atmosphere as they come back down that straight for 200-odd metres on the track and then into the paddock, which has changed apparently just last year. But they still come down the track, and these horses are applauded. It's really quite magical.
And, you know, that never fails, even here in Australia, having that connection between the race fans and the horse. Put the gambling aside, it'll always be there. Well, there'll always be punters, and we all like a punt. But the connection, the definitive thing is the animal, the horse.
Absolutely, and every now and again, of course, when the freak comes along, it will engage the entire population. You can't hoodwink the population about that. You can't invent this horse that's better than it is. But when they turn up like a Black Caviar or Kingston Town, you know, the people appreciate it. The punters appreciate it. You know, we sit there and watch, you know, 25 races where none of us were probably going to bet in them when Black Caviar was going around, other than take a silly little first four or something. So then it becomes beyond the betting. And that's still a great attraction to me. I still love the great horses.
Did you enjoy, you were there for Black Caviar? At Royal Ascot?
Yes.
I saw you there.
Extraordinary day. I remember it vividly in the sense that the whole crowd sensed what had happened in those closing, 15 metres, 20 metres at most. There was this collective, what the hell? Yeah. Now, people don't normally pick things up like that in a race. The other thing that struck me was before the race, there was an electric atmosphere. And the Poms were cheering her. They weren't hanging off her tail.
No question.
They wanted to see her do something like they'd seen from Frankel earlier in the carnival. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be. I walked out of the track just coincidentally that day at the same time as Luke Nolan. He walked over and he put his arm around me and he said, "Steve," he said, "please be kind to me." And what I think, I had the greatest respect for Luke Nolan because he's... very intelligent bloke. I don't underestimate Luke Nolan's intelligence, but he realised immediately that he'd turned the story into him and not her. And that was his regret. And at the end of the day, she won. She won. She beat Moonlight Cloud, who had won, what, 5 Group 1 races in her own right. So,
but in his defence, the media went straight after him. Like, there's nothing like the English media. And there was a noose party, you know, gathering. Why did you drop your hands? You went to sleep. We found out later, not on the day, that she was hurting. There was a problem.
Yes. And I think coupled with the fact, too, that I remember the good old Peter Moody had given Luke a bit of a bollocking for giving her a backhander in Adelaide. So I wonder whether that was also, you know, playing on Luke's mind a little bit too, that I better not get too vigorous here. Oh, look, he made a mistake. There's no doubt he made a mistake. He eased, you know, that 15 or 20 minutes, 20 metres before the line. But at the end of the day, the records record that she won.
A fellow said to me, going back to the coach there that particular day, he said, think about it slowly. 25 for 25. This was at the end. But she was 22 for 22 at that stage. The balloon hadn't been pricked. Interesting. Steve Moran is very interesting. He's our special guest this morning on This Is Your Racing Life, and we'll take this break for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Steve Moran joining me this morning on This Is Your Racing Life. You touched on characters and the characters that you and I grew up with in our time, me in the broadcast box, you in the press room. We'd, as you say, at the end of the day, you'd go to the committee room and have a beer after a day was done, but those days are all gone. But the characters, they're sort of thin on the ground now.
Yeah, look, I'm sure there's plenty of them out there. I think I'd like to see a bit more of probably the trainers involved in our TV coverage of racing. There's nothing, you know, we all love to hear from the participant. It doesn't matter what sport we follow. I think it's part of the reason the Big Bash has worked. You've got relatively recently retired players like Ricky Ponting and Adam Gilchrist entertaining the audience. Now, our problem in racing, of course, is the trainers don't retire, and jockeys tend to linger forever and ever as well. I think we need to start beseeching a couple of the trainers, and there's plenty of entertaining guys out there. You get Robbie Lang or Pat Carey talking on racing history, pedigrees, who won what, and they're extraordinary. And, you know, guys like John Sadler and Lee Friedman, who are just naturally entertaining. I think somehow if we could get them involved in particularly the night racing coverage, just beseech them of their time for just to come in and, you know, not a 5-minute interview, sit there for an hour, be part of the coverage, tell us something we don't know.
Yeah, no, agree entirely. It's a no-brainer. The media, mainstream media now, the racing coverage, looking at the Melbourne paper, the Sun Herald, through the spring and to the autumn to some degree, fantastic, but a couple of days have gone by. Just recently, there wasn't a note on racing. Now, from a guy who's come through that world, you know, over three and a half decades, must sadden you in some way.
Yeah, it does. Look, I think we've probably all dropped the ball because I think that general level of interest in racing probably hasn't declined as much as people like to think. You know, if you add up every single attendee at every single race meeting on a Saturday afternoon in Australia, including the 327 they have in Queensland, which is extraordinary, you know, every person standing in a pub tab, having a little flutter on their phone account, watching Sky or racing.com, you know, I think the level of interest is still fundamentally there, but over the years we've probably let it slip in terms of how sports editors perceive it. They perceive that no one cares outside the Spring Carnival. I don't think that's quite right. I think it's probably been incumbent on the industry, and it's probably not too late. You know, don't invite me to your friendly gala booze up. You know, invite the sports editors and the news directors of the TV stations. Get them involved. And look, that may come to zero. Personally, I think the racing.com website arm should be actively generating stuff for the mainstream outlets. I don't think there's any point having this stuff posted on racing.com. You're preaching to the converted. You know, every morning, send someone out to Flemington, get some footage, send it to the news networks. You know that, you know, Brian, you've worked in it. There'll be one day a week, there's nothing much happening. Yep. Oh, here's a nice little grab from so-and-so at Flemington with, you know, they'll run it. But they won't run it if you've put it on your website 2 hours earlier.
No,
you know?
It won't be found. That's exactly right. That's an interesting comment. Where do you sort of see it now, Steve? Where do you sort of see it heading in terms of marketing? You know, we've got a plethora of racing clubs here in this state. We've got virtually 4 clubs. You've got VRC, Melbourne Racing Club, Moonee Valley, and Racing Victoria. It's virtually 4 clubs, really.
Well, In an ideal world, I'd be disbanding Racing Victoria and Racing New South Wales. It reflects life in this country, doesn't it? We've got one too many tiers of government, federal, state, local, same in racing. It would take a lot of will from a lot of people, and it's probably almost impossible, but nothing's impossible. I think the competition amongst the clubs is a good thing. I think the top-heavy expenses incurred by administration in the state bodies is absurd when you reflect on the fact that once upon a time, you know, the VRC ran racing in the state, the AJC ran racing in New South Wales with the secretary and probably the finance manager, the accountant, two junior clerks and the tea lady. And they didn't often get things horrendously wrong. I honestly don't see why it couldn't happen. Process of attrition over the next 10 years, someone resigns, let's start to absorb some of these functions into one national body, eliminate the state bodies. That would be my hope in 20 or 30 years' time.
Racing Victoria at the moment doesn't have a chairman. It has an interim CEO. We can't sugarcoat the fact that the last couple of years don't look good on the showreel.
No, they don't. And I applaud Martin Pakula, the racing minister. I think he's done the right thing. I've spoken to him. He acknowledges that it's going to be difficult to find the right constitution for this board. I don't think it's absolutely important that the board members are immersed in racing. I think that's what your senior management's for. And in fact, I think it works better that way. If you've got two or three experienced administrators at the top who then put proposals to the board, and the board is going to look at it from an objective point of view and an analytical point of view and a business point, well, convince me why we should do this. I also think it doesn't hurt for one or two of these board members to have some level of interest. It just got to be that it can't be your primary means of income. As simple as that. And you can't have a direct connection to any particular body. You know, the bloke who owns 10% of Four Horses, he's probably ideal if he's got a business track record.
Integrity issue keeps bobbing up. We can't hide the facts that it's been a long haul for the Cobalt inquiries. It extends to all different areas. And the brand and the image keeps getting beaten up.
It does. I mean, it's a bit of a standing joke now amongst the trainers that, it'd be good if the integrity department stopped bringing racing into disrepute by constantly launching these charges, and we've had a couple that have been probably ill-prepared, is fair to say. The thing that worries me a little bit with the racing police, and I'm not singling anyone out in particular, I think it's a bit of an attitude that's pervading all of them now. They seem to me to be starting from this premise that everyone's dishonest, everyone's cheating. Surely you start from the other. Everyone's honest and everyone's straight until I've got concrete evidence otherwise. Now, it's racing. It involves a lot of money. There's going to be people doing the wrong thing. But I don't think there's as many doing the wrong thing as this perception would have us believe.
Yeah. Okay, the other issue that's widely discussed is, there's too much racing. The players, the participants will say, we need more time off. Why can't we get Monday off? The TAB will turn around and the corporate bookmakers say, no, you can't have Monday off because the machine has to keep turning over and turning over. We race for 363 days of the year, Good Friday and Christmas Day, and I'm sure there'll be a push for eventually to run on those days too. Who knows? How are we going to get that balance right? Because you talk to the players, the Robbie Langs and the trainers, they say, well, you know, if we do the night meeting, by the time we get home and get up for track work the next day, we're like a zombie. Well, I suppose the immediate reaction is, well, don't bother, don't play. Hmm. How do you read it?
Yeah, look, I think we do have a saturation. My worry would be is that none of this saturation coverage of racing breeds a new generation to follow the game. The only way that happens is if you go to the races. And I think one of our greatest assets is the picnic racing circuit, which draws huge crowds at very little expense to the industry at large. I think there's an argument for possibly reducing the number of race meetings we have. I'd possibly even be in favour of having more races at fewer meetings, other than the feature meetings. I don't want 10 races on Caulfield Cup Day, Melbourne Cup Day, Cox Plate Day. It diminishes the product, in my opinion. Perhaps we don't need to be as few as the UK, but I think seven or eight is fine. Have more races on these fodder programs. Run 12 if it's all about just generating the turnover. Start the night meet a little bit earlier. Capture the guy who's knocking off work and walked into the pub tab at 4:30. Get the guys still sitting at home and watching them at 9:30. That's one possible solution. I think a significant reduction in the number of meetings, as much as we'd all love it, and I certainly would, but it's probably not going to happen.
The timing of races and race meetings starting, and this is a pet of mine, there seems to be a total sort of ignoring of 12 to 1. You know, 12 to 1, isn't it a prime time to get going?
Yeah, I would have thought so. In the good old days, the local tab would be chock-a-block, wouldn't it, at lunchtime?
Get a start, a luck tester.
Yes. I'd probably duck back out at 3:15 if you were lucky enough. Yeah, look, I think that's a point too. I think we've lacked a bit of imagination. And I'd like to think that over recent years, I'm not these days inclined to knock left field ideas, which I might have done once and said, oh, well, that's just silly. I think we're at the stage where pretty much try anything. You know, the Melbourne Racing Club came up with a few that were hailed down. But I think they're generally to be applauded. When you look at cricket and football, who have practically reinvented themselves in recent history.
No question of that.
You know, 2020 cricket, how old is it? 10, 12 years? They have reinvented themselves. We just still do the same old thing, really, other than a bit of night racing at Moonee Valley, and I applaud them for that. And I think at the time when they started the night racing, they got very little industry support. That's been an innovation. I've often thought, you know, cocktail racing at Caulfield, close to town, right demographic. Why not have a meeting at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon? 4:30 to 7:30, six races, bang, come for cocktails. I think we just need to try something different. I'd like a bit of 2020 racing, but then we've got to get some agreement again between Racing Victoria and Racing New South Wales. Why shouldn't there be a nice little feature race program, Canterbury, Moonee Valley, 15 minutes apart each venue, as in 30 minutes apart each venue, 15 minutes apart, last three races at both venues, decent races, races of some interest. You know, they don't have to be $1 million group ones, but, you know, $200,000 group threes, $150,000, and generate some interest there, capture a television audience for an hour or an hour and a half with six decent races.
Look, I think it's worth a fly. We tried it a little bit with Canterbury and Moonee Valley going back a few years. Then someone switched to Thursday night and the other one stayed at Friday night. So that sort of fell over, that idea. But recently, it was last week, I think it was, there was a race running late due to a protest at the Magic Minions. Flemington jumped at the same time. I mean, can you believe that?
Well, single gauge railway, isn't it? Can you believe that we still have these differences between, particularly, you know, Victoria and New South Wales? Because let's face it, if they reach an accord on any matter, you know, the rest of the country will follow suit. And that's not to be smug sitting here as a Victorian. It's just a fact. And the fact is that, you know, still something like 85% of the turnover is on Sydney and Melbourne. So, you know, the rest of the country recognises that. They lead the way and unfortunately, I think there's been a lack of leadership in recent years.
Okay, we're taking a break. We're going to come back with Steve Moran. This is Your Racing Life on 1116 SEN. And Steve has written something very interesting, which has created a lot of interest, particularly online, about the hot potato in racing, the whip rule. We'll be back after this break. The Toten Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Back with This Is Your Racing Life. Recently online on a website called RaceNet and on another website that you work for, ANZ Bloodstock?
Yes, the two whip pieces have both appeared on the RaceNet site and drawn extraordinary reaction and big reaction on Twitter as well, the general social media. It's a topic that certainly divides, but the one thing that I found particularly interesting to this first one, which was when I suggested that a whip ban was inevitable, that the feedback was generally pretty balanced and measured. It wasn't a lot of people ranting and raving, which I found very interesting. You know, often the racing feedback tends to be a bit of a rant, but this said to me that even those people who don't think it's inevitable and think it should be retained tend to have reasoned arguments, which says to me that this is probably one of the key issues in racing.
And I'll tell you what, Steve, in reading it and the way you've dissected it, etc., your headline was, it was an opinion piece. You said, in my opinion, it's only a matter of time until whips are banned from Australian horse racing. So it's time jockeys, trainers and punters began to prepare themselves for the inevitable. And you go on to say, the situation, I love a punt, I'd love to see a jockey doing their utmost to win. I have no torch to carry for the extremists in the animal welfare world, at least until they adjourn and solve the ethical, intellectual and philosophical debate of mankind's treatment of animals. But I'm a realist. And going down further in the article, you talk about the trends and the comments from the jockeys, the punter. And I was interested in the horseman, the trainer, particularly a guy called Julian Welsh, who arguably he's clerk of the course, but is probably the leading horse breaker that we have here in Victoria. He says, I appreciate some may have a different view, but for me, banning the whip would make not one iota of difference.
That was extraordinary. In fact, I rang Julian largely because I thought I probably should balance this and hear someone who's probably almost certainly going to say, oh, no, you can't do that. You can't possibly entertain a whip ban. He floored me. He said, I do not use it in breaking and educating and pre-training these horses. He said, we carry one because most of these horses are going to other stables where they're going to be ridden by people who do carry them. He said, but we don't use it. I spoke to Mike de Kock in Dubai. He said, I'm an advocate of banning the whip. Now, again, it floored me. I thought, you know, here's this... You know,
one of the leading trainers in the world, no question.
Yeah. So I think there's enough evidence for enough people to say that it isn't necessary. Glenn Boss's comments are interesting too. He says it's a complete misnomer that horses will improve when repeatedly struck with the whip. The counter to that is Robbie Griffiths says, well, you know what, no horse feeling pain will run faster. So therefore my argument is the use of the whip now is not inflicting pain because they wouldn't run any quicker, but it does provide a little stimulus, a little encouragement, a little wake up, you know, come on, boy, we're switching on now. I think it comes down to the fact that jockeys as a collective would have to convince me now on this argument that it's a safety tool. If they can do that, I would suggest, well, this ban is not inevitable. If they can't do it, I think it is inevitable.
The idea of a jockey having to count the number of strokes or hits that he can have over the last portion of the race, he can't sort of, you know, overuse it in an earlier part of the race. But it's maybe we need to change the term and not call it the whip, call it the persuader or the encourager.
Yes, look, somebody emailed me last week too, and I put this stuff in a follow-up piece, and it was very reasoned and very sensible. And this person's argument, quite a prominent racing person, but he didn't particularly want to be named, was that perhaps we gradually introduce the ban. We would begin with next season's two-year-olds. The jockeys may carry a whip. They may only use it forward of the saddle in a encouraging motion with a slap down the shoulder as opposed to the big backhander on the rump. And then he said, obviously, the following year, it's the two-year-olds again, so you've got two crops, two-year-olds, three-year-olds, and you might extend it to then the following year. So eventually all of these horses would become used to that fact that, yes, the jockey can still carry a whip. It can only be used with a slapping motion forward of the shoulder. Makes a bit of sense to me.
Stewards in policing this, there has been a situation, I think in Queensland, was it placings or was it a win where placings were changed because of excessive use? Can you imagine the fallout with a race like a Melbourne Cup or a Caulfield Cup or a Cox Plate was taken away from an owner because of that whip ruling?
Mm. Or the alternative. And as much as people laugh, you know, if I had the runner-up in the Melbourne Cup beaten a half-head and the jockey on the winner had contravened the rules, I'm going to court. I am absolutely going to court, you know, unless my legal advice is it's going to cost me a fortune and I've got no hope. But I don't think I would have no hope. You'd have to be extremely tempted to take the matter to court.
Well, if your jockey's doing the right thing and the other guy has, you know, gone over his allocated, you know, numbers of times he can strike the horse and you've been beaten a half-head in a Melbourne Cup, you'd be running straight to the stewards, wouldn't you? Or would you?
Well, I suppose unless they put it in the rules of racing that a horse, you know, may not be disqualified from the race despite any breach of the whip rule. It's interesting, another fascinating piece from a lawyer written on the RaceNet website a couple of weeks ago talking about the powers that exist within your contract as a licensed person within the racing industry. And to some degree, the stewards have got more power in terms of licensed people than the police have in some instances. So, you know, it's pretty dangerous ground.
Mm. Okay, that's an interesting one. The debate will continue on, and that's good, lively debate. And that's what social media has now done. You know, everyone can have a say. You've got keyboard heroes and you've got haters and lovers and everything else. An interesting situation with this jockey who did this dramatic right turn, cart right, in a race last, like a week ago today at Morfordville. Took two other horses out of play, and his girlfriend won the race. That's love, isn't it?
Well, it's
outrageous. It's very dangerous.
It's outrageous. Look, it's a tricky one. No one, you know, we don't know why he did it. Assuming it didn't involve any sort of betting activity, I think we have to be, to some degree, a little bit understanding. I mean, I suspect this kid might have some problems. I don't know. Let's see what the inquiry finds out, but I don't believe in this, you know, hang 'em high. It is a bit of a contemporary attitude, isn't it, that nobody's allowed a mistake. Nobody is allowed a mistake.
You've written about this and you've called it noose or nurture.
Yes, and I think that this attitude of people that, you know, hang everyone immediately is very common in these days, unless, of course, it happens to involve ourselves and suddenly we're singing from a very different hymn book. But I think we need to see what transpires here. The young man did the wrong thing. It was outrageous. It was horrendous. But let's see how this case unfolds and its merits, I think, first.
It didn't look good. You know, as you say, the lynching party were calling for head straight away. And it'll be, let's leave it to the stewards and see how it plays out. And if it digs deeper as to how this young man is mentally, well, let's try and cut him some slack, so to speak. Steve, as editor of The Best Bets and, you know, as a form analyst, and talking to Dean Lester about this, the punt, it's not science, it's a different beast, isn't it now?
Yes, I'd say it's more about feel, and that's probably what is difficult to teach people who don't grow up with it. And I think it's changed dramatically probably in the last 20 years in terms of sophistication. I think Australian punters and Australian form analysts are the most sophisticated in the world by that far. It doesn't matter. I think it stemmed to some degree from a lot of blokes that I met when I first started with Best Bets in 1997, when we revamped it. And, you know, guys like Brendan Tupper and Mark Hunter and Chris Beaumont and Howard Walter, and then later, of course, Dean, and just putting a greater emphasis on analysis and probably the reading of a race. And as I say to people, that's the first thing that you've got to have some understanding of. You know, I draw the analogy of Coe and Ovette, the athletes running at the mile. You know, Coe would win every time if they dawdled because he could sprint. If it was a run at a solid pace, Ovette would win because he was stronger and had the greater stamina. And, you know, at the end of the day, you've got a 1,600-metre mile race for horses. If the leaders run the first half in 51, Burnborough's not going to pick them up. No, it's just physically impossible. Now, I don't think you need to get to quite the level of analysis now that some people have taken it to. I think you just need to get a feel for the race. And the sectionals are handy in just looking at the mid-race splits. Just get a feel for what happened. Don't always trust your eye. I think they're really handy for things like races out of that chute at Sandown, because your eye can deceive you there, probably straight races, although they tend to be run at a dawdling tempo all the time these days. But I think in terms of sectional times, just get a feel for the race, confirm what you saw. You think they went slowly, just check that first 800 split and make sure that your eyes aren't deceiving.
I think that's something on racing.com, which is a great tool for punters, those split sectionals of 12.3 for the first 200 metres. The tempo goes up, the tempo drops down. You've only got to look at the clock. It's the same in swimming races, in running races. It doesn't matter where you go. The clock doesn't lie. So you know that they're going to come home in 10 and a half seconds. So if you're 8 lengths off them, you're not going to run 9.5 to beat them, are you?
No. I think the first thing I would, you know, teach any kid who asked me would be, you know what, when we watch this race replay, I want you to watch the horse that ran fourth, beaten 2.25 lengths, who trucked on the fast pace and was second up. Don't watch the thing flashing home running last. Everyone's seen that. Yeah. It'll be, you know, I think Banjo Patterson said it 100 years ago. You know, A, it'll be under the odds next time it goes around. B, if it was slow to begin and flashed home late, there's every chance it'll be slow to begin and flash home late again next time. Yeah. So I think that's part of the feel to it. You know, look at that horse. He's probably got some fitness potential improvement. Had a reasonably tough run. Probably not too tough a run. But again, that gets into the feel of it, doesn't it? If the horse had too much of a gut buster, you probably don't want to be on next time. But, you know, hard run, second up, fitness to come. That's the sort of horse I'd like to be on.
It's an interesting call about where you rate our punters here in Australia, you know, up sort of near the top or the top. And do we overanalyse? Are we relying too much now on, you know, track bias, you see jockeys after one race, all of a sudden they're coming up the middle of the track. There are people walking tracks telling jockeys where they should be, where they shouldn't be. Are we digging too deep?
Yeah, possibly in terms of tactics. I'm inclined to treat all tracks as playing fairly unless there's absolutely dramatic evidence to the contrary, because we tend to go off too soon. Secondly, I think you get very few biased tracks when they're good for or better. You know, the bias tends to occur when they're rain-affected, in my opinion. Good tracks, I think we tend to overreact. But I think the sophistication of our punters is bloody amazing. There's no such thing as the mug punter. No. The bloke betting $20 here knows exactly what's going on, you know, 95% of the time. He might be a mug, because like all of us, he has too many bets or has too many beers when he's having a bet. But in terms of knowing what's going on, incredibly well-informed. Oh, not so much well-informed. They are that. But I think they've just grown up, punters in this country, with a good sense of reading the form and knowing how it's playing.
Many years now with the Hong Kong Jockey Club, it's a different world over there. It's an enormous success story, Hong Kong racing. You can watch every meeting, you can do your form, you can bet on every meeting, so you don't have to be there. What is it that draws you to Hong Kong?
Well, I think it's, first of all, it's the city itself, which is so vibrant, never stops, 24 hours a day. The buzz is fantastic. In terms of atmosphere, it's almost impossible to be going to a race meeting at Happy Valley in the middle of the island on a Wednesday night when there might be sort of 25,000 people there surrounded by the skyscrapers. The atmosphere there is fantastic. I think the standard of the racing at the top level is terrific. You get very few of these sit and sprint races that we tend to get here in Australia these days, which annoys the hell out of me. You know, those major races in Hong Kong, don't take a faint-hearted horse, you know, because they are going to run 48 flat for the first half in a mile race there. You know, they are going to go quickly in the sprint. No one's handing up. You know, you're not going to ease back or slide forward and think someone's going to let you in. It ain't happening. You know, you're posted 3D throughout. So the intensity of the racing there is terrific. You know, the scrutiny is brilliant. The standard of the horses at the top end is really good, but most of them are coming from here. I often wonder now, you know, if we had the likes of, you know, Werther and Eagle Way and, you know, these Queensland Derby performers who've both disappeared there in the last 2 years, and there's a string of others, you know, would our racing at that top level be much more competitive? Would our weight for age races revert back to the 70s and 80s where there'd be four, five, six chances in a decent weight for age race? So it is a little counterproductive there. But on the other hand, if I've got a horse who wins a midweek three-year-old at Sandown and someone in Hong Kong wants to give me $900,000 for it, I'm taking it.
Yep, and you'll throw in the bridle as well. The internationalisation of our great spring carnival, the Melbourne Cup, it changed in 1993 with Vintage Crop. It's amazing to watch, to see where it is now.
Yes, and it had to happen, and I applaud the fact that it happened. I must admit I'm on the view that we only have one race in this country that requires international competitors. That's the Melbourne Cup. I don't think there's anything to be gained by having international runners, even in the Cox Plate, because you're never, ever going to get the A-grader. You know, they're just coming off the arc. It's British Champions Day. It's Irish Champions Day in Ireland, obviously. That was a bit Irish. So I don't think... it's not worthwhile. It's not worthwhile. The Cup, I love it. It's a handicap. You pay your money and you take your chances. And they do pay their money. And, you know, they run that risk of if they can run 10th and pick up, what is this, probably about 120,000 now, that's probably barely break square. So they pay their money and they take their chances. I think it's fantastic. As to other races, just not necessary in my opinion.
Good to chat with you this morning. Again, I keep saying this every week. I could go another hour. And we can always come back. But thanks for your time and congratulations on a career that's a ripping career. We're talking to you from Steve's place this morning, overlooking the Bat Beach here at Rye. Sort of like a hermit existence sitting up here. You're loving it, aren't you?
Well, it is a little bit cloistered down here, but... Yeah, my kids live on the peninsula and they now have children too, which apparently would make me a grandfather. I have no problem with the title. Sorry, no problem with the role. I'm just not too sure about the title.
Good to see you, Steve.
Thanks, Brian.